യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാണ തോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ചരമണിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാവിവരണസ്യ ച. We are continuing the discussion so we will go to the 14th and 15th sutras. So before that, one important point to remember is what is mentioned in the third sutra of this Kaivalya Pada. The sutra is nimittam aprayojagam prakritinam varanabhedastu tatah kshetrigavad. This is the sutra. It's a very complex sutra, and in fact it gives you the whole theory of evolution according to Vedanta, according to yoga, and according to Sankhya philosophy. So you'll be surprised, those of you who have studied modern science will be surprised that yoga philosophy and Vedanta philosophy are more inclined towards evolutionism than creationism. It takes just the opposite view of creationism. That's very interesting. So, in other words, it believes in what could be called reverse evolution. You may all remember, most of you, that Vivekananda defined religion as the manifestation of divinity already in all of us, in man. That's his statement. Means religion or spirituality is nothing but gradual unfoldment of the divine reality that is present, that is immanent in all of us. So when we grow in spirituality, what is happening is we are coming closer and closer to our own true nature, and everything else is alien to us. In other words, ignorance is alien. Error, evil, negativity, these are all alien to our true nature. Our true nature is that we are divine. So all spiritual practices, reading scriptures, listening to great spiritual ideas, prayers, meditation, noble activities, philanthropy, all these are very, very helpful, because they help you to understand our true nature. These spiritual practices are indirectly helpful in our effort to discover ourselves, rather rediscover ourselves. So that means when we evolve, we are evolving from spirit to nature. When you go through this process of reverse evolution, it's called involution, we are going back from matter to spirit. So when we identify ourselves with this physical body, and it's a very gross aspect of our personality, we are actually identifying ourselves with what we actually are not, this matter. And again, behind this material body, the five senses, five elements, there is the intellect, there is the ego system. So gradually we evolve from gross to subtle, and finally we reach the source of all evolution, which is called Prakriti. And once we reach there, then we identify ourselves not with Prakriti but Purusha, and Purusha is the divine reality present in all of us. This is the purpose of all spiritual practices. This is the purpose of religion. This is the purpose of prayer and meditation. And this is the purpose of following the teachings of saints. Not to follow them, but to discover that saintliness within ourselves. So our purpose in following the teachings of great spiritual teachers is to become like them, and not to become just their worshippers, but to become like them. So when we meditate, when we think of a spiritual ideal, we naturally develop some of those characteristics in our own nature. So if your idea of God is very compassionate, all merciful person, then you naturally be compassionate and merciful. So that is yad bhavayati tad bhavati. It is in Vedanta. What you meditate upon, that you become. What you idolize, that you become. This happens in ordinary human life. Children who become fans of footballers, they want to be like them, to play like them. Those who want to be musicians, those who have become admirers of musicians, they want to learn music and become great musicians, poets, anything. So even the ordinary human life situation, this applies. So in this evolution, what is happening is every spiritual practice is removal of obstacles. So this sutra is very technical, you know, it's something very profound. Nimittam aprayochakam. So whatever we practice, whatever spiritual practices we do, their utility is limited to this. Beyond that, they have no utility. What's the utility? Well, suppose there is a reservoir of water, a lake, and there is a field that you want to irrigate. But there is a gap 20 meters of earth. So when you cut a canal, what happens? That part of the earth is removed and water starts flowing towards the canal, to the field. So you have not done anything except removing that part of the earth which existed between the lake and the field which you wanted to irrigate. So every spiritual practice is removing the hindrances, obstacles that stand in our way of coming back to our own nature. In other words, in reverse evolution. It's called involution. So that's why the analogy is taken, varana bhedastu. Bheda means crushing, breaking, removing. Varana means a barrier. What's a barrier? This 20 meters of earth that existed between the lake and the field which you wanted to irrigate. It is removed, maybe in a rectangular, in the form of a, let's say, a canal or something, or a stream. And once that earth is removed, then water flows the field. Like that, meditation, spiritual practices, feeding our mind with good thoughts, attending prayers, listening to useful spiritual talks, all these will help us to be aware of this varana, means the barrier. You break it. How do you break it? Through meditation, through spiritual practice, through yama and yama, you know, ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha. Non-violence, truthfulness, non-stealing, non-possessiveness, and not accepting things from others which we don't actually need. And then self-restraint, contentment, inner contentment. So contentment, the ability to find joy in what we already have, so that we won't strive for something which we do not have or which may belong to others. So that is ahimsa, satya, asteya. Asteya means, the technical translation will be stealing. It should not be taken literally. What it means is having no desire for things that belong to others to possess them, because that makes the mind restless. And that restlessness leads to action. Actions to possess or to get those things. And actions do not always succeed. If you don't succeed, mind becomes unhappy. So contentment. It's called, you know, santosha. Santosha actually not only contentment, joyful contentment in what we already have. So all these spiritual practices, what they do, they break the barrier between ourselves and our spiritual growth. So that's why example is given, you know, Kshetrigavat. It's like a field. That is the example given. Now this we kept in mind again and again when we go to the next sutra. The next sutra, 14th and 15th, it'd be interesting, you know, it is actually a refutation of one school of Buddhist philosophy called Vijnanavada or what is called Yogacara. The essence of Vijnanavada is this: a thing exists only so long as you perceive it. That's what it essentially, in short. And they came to be called Yogacara because they believed in yoga practices. So I called, it's a kind of subjective idealism. Maitreyanatha was the original, supposed to be the original teacher. And he had a disciple, his name was Asanga. And then he had a disciple, Vasubandhu. They all lived. And during that time, many of their works were translated into Chinese. And many of the original books were retrieved from, retrieved the original Sanskrit form by some great scholars who got them back with the help of the available Chinese translations, mostly done by a great pilgrim called Huyen Sang, who must have visited India around 7th century, 8th century AD. So we need a little introduction of this Vijnanavada. Remember, it doesn't say that Vijnanavada is wrong. An Indian hermeneutic tradition, refutation of a system of philosophy is not like Karl Marx refuting, Immanuel Kant refuting empiricism or early systems of philosophy in his Critique of Pure Reason. It is not like that earlier systems of thought are wrong or they are totally misleading. Not in that way. If A is true, it doesn't mean that everything other than A are all wrong. Not at all. So that should be kept in mind. So Vedanta, non-dualistic system of philosophy, Vedanta accepts the idea that objects do have an ontological reality independent of perception. But Vijnanavadins, this particular school of Buddhist philosophers, argued that external objects have an ontological reality only so long as we perceive them. So these are some of the views put forward. So just maybe I shall give some background of this system of philosophy, because these sutras are very, very important. Vyasa has added another sutra which may not be found in some of the original Patanjali Yoga Sutra literature, which emphasized the point. So this is a simple point, remember. In Buddhist tradition, there are four schools of philosophy. They are technically called four schools of later Buddhism. Later because the earlier Buddhism did not have any well-structured metaphysical systems. They were all mostly based on the teachings of Buddha. Four noble truths, the reality of grief or discontentment in a Chatvari Arya Satyani. There is grief, there is a reason for the grief, there is a way out of the grief or sorrow, and the way out is nirvana. This common central principle based on Buddhism was nothing but the humanistic interpretation of Vedanta. So this is early, it's called early Buddhism. That means the concept of nirvana based on eight disciplines, you know, Sammik Drishti, Sammik Vyayama, Sammik Ajiva, Sammik Vak, Sammik Samadhi, and so on. Proper, appropriate meditation, appropriate righteous meditation, righteous livelihood, righteous conduct, righteous, word, Sammik Vak, Sammik Vyayama, Samyak Ajiva, Samyak Smriti, proper righteous memory and righteous samadhi and so on. Eight disciplines, which if you follow, you get out of this grief. And this grief is causing this continuous cycles of life, death and rebirth, which constitute a state of imperfection. And this is a state of imperfection that we should try to come out of. And the way to come out of this is to attain nirvana. This is the essence of Buddhism. So this was all that Buddha taught and preached. So all these teachings were mostly done in Prakrit language, which is the vernacular form, which were later on recorded in Pali canonical literature, which actually were recorded around 50, 60 years after Buddha's passing away, when a number of Buddhist monks and nuns assembled in what is now, close to what is now called Patna, the city of Patna, India's Bihar state, Rajagriha, where the first religious council in the history of the world. It happened about 50, 60 years after Buddha's passing away. And Buddha passed away, according to many historians, around 480 BC. So maybe in 430, 420 BC, you have to count backward, you know, BC before Christ. So the first Buddhist council. In that Buddhist council, many of the Buddhist monks and nuns, they remembered Buddha's original teachings given in Prakrit language, and they were all recorded in Pali script. It's called Pali canonical literature. It's called the Pali canons of Buddhism. That is Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka. Together they constitute the philosophy, the metaphysics, the disciplines of Buddhist monastics, and the structure, the fundamental doctrines, everything. And in these three Pitakas, Pitaka means in Pali, it means baskets. Three means three. So, Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka. It's got many chapters. In fact, this Dhammapada comes in Sutta Pitaka, actually. The most famous book and Buddhist tradition. Modern times, of course. I mean, right now it's current. So there are much more profound books, of course, in Buddhist tradition. So this was the philosophical landscape of Buddhism till about 3rd century BC. But then from 2nd century, 1st century BC onwards, right up to around 6th or 7th century AD, a large number of Buddhist metaphysical systems grew in Buddhist tradition. All these books were written in Sanskrit, not in Pali. So these four schools are called, they are mainly four fundamental schools. They are called four later schools of Buddhism, or later schools of Buddhism. Four streams of thought belonging to the later schools of Buddhist philosophical evolution, of which two schools were realistic and two schools were idealistic. So the idealistic schools are Shunyavada and Vijnanavada that we are going to discuss with Patanjali is referring to now. These are called idealistic schools, two schools of idealism, Buddhist idealism. One is Shunyavada, which is attributed to its main exponent, Nagarjuna, who wrote Madhyamika Karika. It's a Bible of Shunyavada, which is very popular in America these days. Many, in fact, Dalai Lama or many Buddhist monks from different Far Eastern countries, they have expounded. Of course, it is, unfortunately, it is translated as the great void and the great emptiness in English translations. It is not void or emptiness. Shunya is a word used in Sanskrit by Nagarjuna. Shunya is their supreme reality. And beneath this reality, this is the absolute reality for Shunyavadins. Below this, there is empirical reality. So Shunya is Paramarthika Satta, Paramarthika Satya, and there is below that is called Samvriti Satya by Buddhist and Vyavaharika Satta by Vedantins. It is empirical reality. All this world, events, all these chairs, tables, all these belong to the empirical realm, empirical reality, relative world. And the absolute reality is Shunya. And that Shunya, according to the original Buddhist philosophers, is one inexplicable, indescribable truth which cannot be said to be this or that, which is non-dualistic in nature, which is beyond description or definition or evaluation or explanation, which is something that you can experience. And so that is unfortunately traditionally translated into the English word emptiness. So in Sanskrit, the mainstream translation of the word shunya is empty. Dictionary meaning, Webster, Oxford, or anything you find, Chambers Dictionary, everywhere. But in Buddhist philosophy, what Nagarjuna implied, and by Chandragirti, he wrote a commentary on Nagarjuna's book, implied was one supreme reality, which is the trans-empirical reality, which you should realize as at the experience level, which is indescribable, non-definable, inexplicable, which is non-dualistic. That's the uniqueness of the system. So I am not going to speak anything on Shunyavada. It's not the context right now. This is the first and most prominent school of idealism in Mahayana Buddhism. The second school of idealism in Mahayana tradition is this Yogacara or Vijnanavada. The two names are equally relevant, used interchangeably. It's called Vijnanavada, which means they believe Vijnanam is the only reality. Vijnanam is Chitta. So in the Yogacara system, Vijnanam could mean Jnanam, Chittam, Vijnanam. Three words are used interchangeably, almost like synonyms. So Vijnanam is the only reality in the world. That is Chittam. So long as you pursue something, it exists. Nothing in this world, no object in this world, has an ontological status of reality independent of perception. It exists so long as you perceive it. It is a much more refined form of subjective idealism than what you find in Berkeley. No, appearance and reality, really speaking, because hundreds, maybe thousands of books have been written on this subject by Maitreyanatha, by Sangha, by Dignaga, and many of them were translated into Chinese and later into Buddhist tradition. All these two schools of philosophy reached Japan and other countries through China. So, there are five treatises by this great speaker. One is Abhisamayalankara and another is Mahayana Sutra Alankara. These are important books which were translated by Huyen Sang into Chinese, which helped the latest scholars and Indologists to retrieve the text, because many of the original Sanskrit texts were destroyed by the Muslim invaders who came to India, Muhammad Bhaktiyar Khilji, who destroyed Nalanda University, which was spread over tens of thousands of acres, which had tens of thousands of students. And so if you are interested, you can go to Nalanda. You can visit the ancient university site, which was built in the maybe around 3rd century BC. The university site is still you find near Patna. So, and Huyen Sang came and he studied and he translated these books. So, this much about Vijnanavada, because to understand the relevance of Patanjali's Sutra, we must keep all this in mind. Now, a few things about this Vijnanavada. So, according to this system, the absolute consciousness, Chittam, is called Tathagata Garbha. It is immanent in all beings. And all impressions that we have got in this world are already located in this fundamental, it's called Alaya Vijnana. So when we connect with certain external objects, then we perceive those objects. The moment those objects are no longer perceived, they no longer exist. So they exist only so long as they are perceived by the perceiver. Vyasa's sutra is Vastu Sami Chitta Bheda Tayohu Vibhaktaha Pantha. That's a sutra. Those who are interested, you can see 15th sutra. So, how Patanjali establishes his point of view is this. An object may be perceived by different people in different ways. As a perception, the way it is perceived could vary, be different from individual to individual. Each individual has its own chittam. Chittam, let's say, mental system, the perceiving mechanism through which we come to know of things, we become aware of things. Buddhist Vijnanavadins, Yogacara, or subjective idealists say that this consciousness is responsible for the ontological reality of what that consciousness becomes aware of. That consciousness means chittam. So you things don't exist if you are not aware of their existence. Now Patanjali says things do have a non-ontological reality whether you perceive it or not. So Patanjali's argument is this: the same object could be perceived by different people in so many different ways. The object doesn't change, the perceptions change. So what changes is not real, what remains relatively unchanging is real. So this idea is pushed forward further by yoga philosophers. Now let us think of 3-4 trains moving. Or let us say 2 trains for the time being. Now, if two trains are moving at the same speed, you don't feel the movement. In order to feel the movement of a changing object, one of the two objects should be unchanging or should be changing slowly. So, if you are sitting in a train which is moving slowly, and watch another train which is moving much faster, then you feel the movement of the train which is moving. If they are moving at the same speed, they are both stagnant. Now, there is something which remains unchanging. Everything in this world is changing. Everything in this world is changing all the time. Changes take place at a very subtle level. Maybe cells are different, the bacteria, all those things that constitute a human body. They keep changing, but those things are so small, so we don't notice, so we feel it is stagnant. Well, let us say, suppose you are traveling in a train, you have a big plate in your hand, and in the hand there is an ant. The ant is running up and down very fast, or maybe tiny dog, let us say, a little animal, cat or dog, running very fast in a moving train or maybe in a bus. Is it actually moving? You ask the dog, it says it's moving. Or ask the ant in the plate, it is moving from one end of the plate to the other end, maybe 10 feet, 20 feet. But that movement doesn't make any difference in the overall context. So each moment is actually real only to that particular little animal or creature. We are sitting there with the plate which is stagnant. We feel we are moving, but the way that creature feels the movement is different. It is not moving 1 mile faster than the train. It may be moving faster within the train, but this overall movement is the same as the speed of the train. So the point is, according to Vijnanavadins, everything in this world is changing. Irikulkshinigadavada means momentariness. And our chittam remains unchanging. Patanjali says, the object, the same object, could be received, could be perceived by so many different people, so many different mental systems, perceiving instruments in so many different ways, but the object that is perceived is relatively unchanging. So that which is relatively unchanging should be more real than the other thing which is changing much faster. So Vastu Swami means that particular object remains the same, but the perceiving mind is, the perception itself is different from individual to individual. Therefore, the reality of objects doesn't depend upon the mind. Everything has got an ontological reality independent of the perceiving mind. This is the way Patanjali tries to question Vijnanavada. This is an interesting to remember. It is, so you find the realism of Patanjali's school of philosophy. It doesn't say that this material world is eternal, but within the relative realm, the objective entities do have an ontological reality independent of the perceiving mind. That's an interesting thing. Remember, not only that, so the Vijnanavada is not accepted by other two schools of realism within Buddhism, Sautrantika and Vaibhashika schools. There are two very important streams of schools of realism in Buddhism, belong to later Buddhism. They are mostly related to Hinayana Buddhism, mostly prominent in Burma, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Thailand, Siam, such countries. You know. So they are realists. They agree with this view. They don't agree with the view that an object depends upon the perceiving mind. An object has an ontological reality. Ontologically, it is a real thing, no matter whether it is perceived or not. So that's the school of realism. Another sutra, na chayega chitta tantram vastu tada pramanagam tada kim siyad. The idea is this. There are many things in the world that you are not aware of, that your consciousness, your mind, your chittam cannot perceive. Does it mean that they do not exist? So, therefore, external objects do have a reality apart from the perceiving mind. So, this is an important point to remember. Now we'll go to another very, very important sutra. The next one is Tat Uparaga Apekshitva Chittasya Vastu Jnana Jnata Ajnatam. So we perceive different things because we distinguish every object, every perceived object from every other perceived object because we see some difference. That also shows that perceived objects have a reality independent of the perceiver's mind. Okay, I will stop now. Those of you who have not got this clear, you can ask questions. It's very interested. You have very interesting subject. You know, Buddhist philosophy is so profound. The vastness of philosophical literature in these four schools of Buddhism, I mentioned, you know, Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. They are two schools related to Mahayana tradition and the Hinayana tradition, there are two equally important schools of realism. So they accept the reality of external objects. Momentariness doesn't amount to total non-existence. That's their view. So those of you who have any questions can ask. Otherwise, I shall continue. So I don't want to overload. You know, I have to. The next sutra, you have to discuss the two schools of realism also. Come on.
Just for the pacing and the break.
On the subject that you just mentioned of the relative reality, the news had the Einstein letter where he was explaining to a lay scientist the growing conviction he had that relativity was true.
Yeah.
And so how do those modern ideas tie to these traditions?
Yeah. See, relativity in philosophy and logic implies the possibility of something which is not relative. That equation, that logic may not apply in physics. See, in philosophy, if you tell that person is taller than language also, which means there is a person, another person who is not so tall. So relative always indirectly implies the existence of something that's absolute. That absolute doesn't become a focus for scientific investigation. That's the main problem. Physics. Now, metaphysics begins where physics leaves the area, but physics doesn't admit that. Metaphysics begins where the physics leaves the realm of investigation. So, maybe great scientists like Einstein came as close as it is possible for a physicist to admitting the reality of an absolute is non-relative. So look at the definition of relative in Vedanta, which is much technically and logically much more comprehensive. According to Vedanta, the relativity is called Maya. And what is that? Anything that belongs to time, space, and causation. Anything that can be understood and defined and explained and described within the superstructure of time, space, and causation. That's what's Maya. So, a thing may exist for billions of years, still it is within Maya. It belongs to time. Space, it occupies space. And causation, it is caused by something other than itself. So anything which is caused by something other than itself cannot be absolute because it did not exist before it came into existence. And coming into existence also will put it within the sphere of time because in the past it did not exist. In future it will not exist. In the present it exists. So relativity is in Vedantic language, relativity is Maya. So very often when we use the Sanskrit word, it's some kind of spooky, superstitious thing we'd say. When you use the relativity, oh, it is wonderful. But actually, Vivekananda, long before Einstein in the 19th century, in his talk in London, Vivekananda was the first modern philosopher who pointed out the error in translating the word Maya into illusion. What Vivekananda said, Maya is relativity. And that is long before Einstein, mind you. So, in philosophy, the relative always implies the logical possibility of the non-relative, that is, the absolute. But that logic doesn't apply to physics because for physics, the relative is the absolute. Though it accepts relativity. So, those of you who are interested, you can continue. Otherwise, I will continue the subject again. Yeah. Any more doubt? Okay. So anyway, so in order to drive home the idea of what this implies, I shall try to explain the other two schools of Buddhism. So the other two schools of Buddhism also refute Vijnanavada and Sautrantika. Sautrantika and Vaibhashika schools is called realistic schools. They both refute Shunyavada and also Vijnanavada. So there was a lot of dialectical warfare between these great philosophers. And in fact, their dialectical activities, philosophical literature, encompass thousands of titles. In fact, tens of thousands still remain to be published in manuscript form. So manuscriptology is an important subject in Indian philosophical conferences, in Sanskrit conferences, manuscriptology. Manuscripts scattered everywhere. Not thousands, hundreds of thousands manuscripts. So the other two schools of Buddhism are called Sautrantika and Vaibhashika. So the Vaibhashika school, there's only minor difference. The Vaibhashika school, they emphasize direct perception. And the Sautrantika school, the other school of realism, they emphasize inference. Because what you perceive now no longer exists. Everything is momentary. So you infer. Anumana. So everything is changing, so you can perceive things only later after it has passed away, because everything is momentary, so you infer. But Vaibhashika school refutes this view by saying you may infer, but inference should have the background of direct perception. That's the idea. So any of those you who want clarification, you can ask. I shall go to the next. So next one is this. Sada jnatas chittavrtteha tat prabhogo purushasya aparinamitva. This is the sutra. Okay, now, here, this sutra takes you to the concept of the absolute reality. Purusha is the word used in yoga literature, yoga philosophy, which has borrowed its metaphysical system from Sankhya. So you should remember, in Sankhya system, there are two absolute realities. Purusha, which is unchanging, which is eternal, which Prakriti, which is changing, which is evolving, which undergoes changes and evolution. So all chitta vrittis, all impressions, waves of mind, they are very well known to Purusha, because the Purusha doesn't undergo evolution or change. Prakriti undergoes evolution of change. So what does it mean? Everything in this world is the result of Prakriti, nature undergoing evolution. So everything in this universe, including our mind, intellect, our ego system, our senses of perception, senses of action, and this empirical phenomenal world, all these constitute 23 evolutes of Prakriti, nature. So at the lowest level, when we identify ourselves with these external objects, we are actually moved far away from our true nature. Through yoga practice, what you are doing is you are trying to turn the evolution backward. You are starting a journey, an ascending journey, going back to your true nature. So when we dissociate through Abhyasa and Vairagya, which I already mentioned, when we dissociate, through detachment, through long practice, when we dissociate, when we non-identify with the external objects or external experiences, we are actually starting the journey going back to our true nature. So I already mentioned this here earlier, you know, Abhyasa Vairagya Abhyam Tat Nirodha is mentioned here. Sātu Dirghakāla Nairandarya Satkāra Asevidu Dridhabhūmi. So, whenever we feel we are enslaved, disturbed by external things or internal anxieties, then we should practice detachment. And detachment is done by constantly reminding ourselves of their impermanent nature. This is something which everyone can practice. Every person knows that all worldly empirical achievements, they may be necessary, but they are not everlasting. They are bound to change. They are bound to disappear. Money, wealth, status, health, everything. No doubt about it. They are bound to go back. They are bound to disappear. Or we will disappear from them eventually, which no one can deny. People may think money will be there all the time. And eventually, you know, really speaking, even people who work in the crematorium, you know, he can be a great philosopher if he wants, but doesn't happen. Why? Because when we return from the crematorium or we're sitting in a cemetery, we know that these things are not going to last. The wealth is not going to last for us, or we won't be with wealth. That very clear. Either we will move away from wealth, or wealth will move away from us. We may lose them. See, everything, everyone knows. So this is an intellectual conviction. But intellectual conviction cannot help you in philosophy, in real life. Because you are convinced of this, but something comes and covers it. So that conviction is there intellectually. Every day if you read, even medical doctors, let us say, medical doctors know that human body is not going to be eternal. At least every medical person knows that. That's how Sir Conan Doyle took to writing, you know, Sherlock Holmes. You know. So even for a very, very mental person, it can happen. So, but that may not make a medical student, a philosopher, a saint. Why? So Vedanta tells you something covers, it's called avarana. Something covers that real truth, the real knowledge or awareness from you. And along with this covering, something else is projected. So the explanation is given in Vedanta. That's why all great thinkers like Vivekananda, Sri Shankaracharya, all of them were unanimous on one point. After studying yoga, you should study Vedanta. Most probably we may start the Vedanta class in the old temple when we shift to that. From yoga, one should evolve to Vedanta. Yoga is the beginning, preparation. It naturally, spontaneously terminates in Vedanta. Now, so Vedanta tells you that even if you know that these things are evolutes of the same Prakriti which are changing all the time, still we forget it. Some inconceivable but really functional entity called Maya, it conceals this truth from us in our everyday life situations by projecting its opposite. So when we fight and quarrel and get worried and anxious and lose sleep over money that we lose in the bank, we have forgotten, well, money is forgotten, that money is bound to disappear. In its place, in the place of that conviction, we play the wrong idea that money is eternal. It should never be lost. There should be always money should be absolute reality. That is the wrong idea. It's called false projection. It's called vikshepa. So concealment of the reality, real truth, followed by the projection of the false idea. Avarana and vikshepa is called vidanta. That happens. So that blocks our forward movement, the realization of the truth. And this can be countered by abhyasa and vairagya. So we must practice these ideas for a long time, without a break, and with a great sense of sanctity. That is called, you know, it should be practiced for a long time. The earlier sutra I already explained, sattu, dirghakala means for a long time, nairandarya means continuously without a break, and with a great sense of sincerity, sanctity, and sacredness, we must practice this proper discerning wisdom, that all that belong to the material world are necessary. We cannot live without them, true, but we can live with them. We can, people can work for them, for acquiring them, but without forgetting the fact that they are not going to be eternal. Their impermanence, transitoriness should not be forgotten when working for them. That's idea. Okay. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna.